Informed Choice Radio, episode 205 with Kate Raworth, Donuts Economics.
I profoundly believe that although the 20th century was driven by the idea that progress is growth, I think in the 21st century we're going to shift to realizing that actually growth lies in finding a healthy balance between meeting all of our needs and staying within the means of the planet. So I think that mainstream economics has misled us. In the 20th century, it lost sight of what it was for. I know that might sound strange, but it lost sight of any goal, partly because economics wanted to be a science. I want to see a revolution in the economics that's taught in universities.
From Sundial House Studios in Cranley, welcome to Informed Choice Radio. This is the podcast all about achieving your financial goals in life. Is your host, Martin Bamford.
What's a donut got to do with the future of economics? My guest on the podcast today is Kate Raworth, and her donut model is making big waves among economists, politicians, and policymakers. Kate is a renegade economist who focuses on exploring the economic mindset needed to address the 21st century's social and ecological challenges. She's the creator of the Donut of Social and Planetary Boundaries. As you'll hear in this episode, it's a simple but important way to think about balancing economic prosperity with available planetary resources. Kate's a senior visiting research associate at Oxford University's Environmental Change Institute, where she teaches on the Masters in Environmental Change and Management. She's also a senior associate at the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. Her internationally acclaimed idea of donuts economics has been widely influential among sustainable development thinkers, progressive businesses, and political activists. And she's also presented its audience ranging from the UN General Assembly to the Occupy movement. And today she presents the donuts to listeners of Informed Choice Radio. Her new book, Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist, was published in the UK and US earlier this month. It's also being translated into Italian, German, Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, and Japanese. Over the past 20 years, Kate's career has taken her from working with micro-entrepreneurs in the villages of Zanzibar to co-authoring the Human Development Report for UNDP in New York, followed by a decade as a senior researcher at Oxfam. She holds a first-class degree in politics, philosophy, and economics, and a master's in economics for development, both from Oxford University. I really enjoyed this conversation with Kate, so much so that it inspired me to read Donut Economics in full and gain a better understanding of the arguments in this book. You can find the show notes, full transcript, and useful links for this episode at icradio.co.uk. If you enjoy listening, please let me know on Twitter at Martin Bamford. Please also say thank you to Kate on Twitter at Kate Raworth. Welcome to Donut Economics with Kate Raworth in episode 205 of Informed Choice Radio. I'm joined today on the podcast by Kate Raworth. Kate, thank you for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure.
Could you start by defining donut economics? It's a fantastic name for a book, but what does it mean?
Yeah, it's a slightly crazy name, isn't it? Because nobody would expect that America's favorite symbol of junk food would somehow be an icon of 21st century human thriving. But when I sat down some years ago to draw a diagram, because I love drawing diagrams, to draw a diagram of what human well-being or prosperity could look like in the 21st century, it, crazy though it sounds, the picture came out looking like a donut. So imagine a donut, the kind with a hole in the middle. In that space in the middle is a place of poverty. It's a place where people are falling short. They've fallen out of the donut into the hole in the middle. They're falling short on life's essentials like decent food and decent housing, healthcare, education, political voice, access to energy and networks. So people are falling short on life's essentials, and we want to get them out of that hole in the middle into the juicy donut itself. But we also have to make sure that collectively we don't overshoot the outer crust of the donut, because out there we're overshooting our pressure on this planet that allows us to thrive. So if we overshoot it, we're causing climate change or the loss of biodiversity, ocean acidification, destroying the ozone layer. We start to put pressure on the critical earth systems that keep us in a thriving space. So we don't want to fall into the hole in the middle, and we don't want to go beyond the outer crust. We want to live in this donut-shaped space itself, which is a safe and just space for humanity. And the reason why that's not just a donut but donut economics was because when I drew this picture, it made me ask a question that all my years of studying economics as a student had never made me ask, which is, if this is a picture of human thriving in the 21st century, where we meet the needs of all within the means of the planet, then what's the economic mindset that's going to give us the greatest chance of getting there? Because I certainly believe that the economics that we learn and use today is not going to get us there. So it set me off on a journey of rethinking economics to make it fit for the 21st century.
And you mentioned there maintaining the equilibrium. So it's something economists are fairly obsessed with doing at the moment, trying to find that happy ground, I guess, between boom and bust and all of the things that go on. Why are economists and the traditional economic model, why is that so obsessed with maintaining the equilibrium?
So boom and bust, they are dangerous states of being, really, in many parts of life. I mean, we think of our own bodies. If we put on way too much weight, but then lose weight even too quickly or too much weight, that's not healthy for us. So health often lies in a state of balance. And when things move too fast up or down, it can really throw the system, whether it's the stock market or the housing market. We know that wild swings aren't good. And especially when it comes to the economy, I'd say that sometimes financiers who are really on the, if they manage to surf the wave of boom and bust, sometimes people can make an absolute killing on the stock market. But ordinary people don't. Ordinary people take the losses. Ordinary people lose their savings. They lose their jobs. They often lose their homes. So a boom and bust is actually an incredibly disruptive process in an economy. And I think it's not a good sign. We want to find an equilibrium. And even in the donut, we don't want people falling into the bust of that hole in the middle of poverty and deprivation. But we also don't want to boom ourselves beyond the outer crust and push our planet out of kilter. So I profoundly believe that although the 20th century was driven by the idea that progress is growth, and we always talk about economic growth as if that's necessarily a good thing, I think in the 21st century, we're going to shift to realizing that actually growth lies in finding a healthy balance between meeting all of our needs and staying within the means of the planet. So I really think we're going to find a profound metaphorical shift and understand that boom and bust isn't good, whether it's in the stock market or indeed in terms of our pressure on the planet.
So before we move on and talk a bit about the 21st century approach and what you hope to see from economics in the future, how it's a bit more friendly and sustainable, I guess, to the planet we live on, what are some of the ways in which mainstream economics have led us astray to date?
So I really asked myself this question when I went back to my economics textbooks from being a student 25 years ago. And by the way, the textbooks have hardly changed. I'm alarmed that today's students are being taught the very same theories that I was taught. Let me mention two of the ways that I think it's led us astray. One, if you say to an economist, show me the biggest picture you've got of the economy, show me a picture of it in context, what they'll show you, it's a diagram called the circular flow diagram, and it looks a bit like a household radiator system with water flowing round and round in closed pipes, and that the water is money and income, and it's flowing between households and businesses. So households provide their labor and they get wages in return, and they use their wages as spending to buy things. So the goods and services go round and round, as does the money. The trouble with that diagram is that it makes the economy look like it's this self-sustaining, free-floating system. It makes absolutely no mention of the living world on which the economy depends. All the resources and material and energy that's drawn into the economy every day, and all the waste and pollution that's spewed out as well. And if we ignore that, we're not even beginning to ask how much through flow of materials and matter can the Earth system take before we start to put too much pressure on our planet. So mainstream economics has ignored the living world. It's also ignored the unpaid care of parents. Every parent is raising their children and doing the cooking, the washing, and the sweeping, and the cleaning to get labor ready for work every day. But that unpaid care is completely ignored. If we ignore these things, the living world and the unpaid care of parents, we're ignoring two of the essential resources that actually enable the economy to thrive. And ignoring it comes back to bite us in terms of the damage to the living world, and also the extraordinary inequality of work that's laid at women's door, unpaid work in the home, even when women are out in the workplace. So ignoring these leads to social and environmental injustice, I'd say. The second way I think that mainstream economics has misled us is in the 20th century, it lost sight of what it was for. I know that might sound strange, but it lost sight of any goal, partly because economics wanted to be a science, like physics. And sciences don't have goals. They're about the study of something. So it stopped articulating what it was for. And in the hole, in that vacuum just like a cuckoo lays eggs in an empty nest. So the cuckoo of economic growth became this proxy goal. And ever since the 1940s, when the measure of GDP, gross domestic product, was first created, we've heard politicians talking about we're promoting growth and the economy is growing as if this was a goal in itself. So economic health, you know, the economy is getting healthy again, it's back on track. And we hear it in the obsession of our politicians today talking about growth isn't just going to be 0.8%, it's going to be 1%. This became a false goal, and it stops us from asking what is causing the economy to grow, what is being depleted or in order for that to happen. Are we cutting down the forest to create timber that we can sell? And who's gaining from that growth? Is it going to the people who really need the benefit of the income? Or is it actually, as is happening, going to the top 10 or even 1% of society? So we need to be far more careful in asking ourselves where growth is coming from, how long it can last, and who's benefiting from it. So we need, and I think we actually need to put goals back at the heart of economics, which is why I drew the donut, because it's a goal for the 21st century to ensure that we can all thrive within the means of the planet.
And I've seen you write recently that it's wealth, not poverty, which is putting the planet under the greatest pressure. So could you explain what that means and why that approach matters?
Yes, I think sometimes people say, oh, gosh, if all those people in Africa and Asia, if they had, you know, food and houses and fridges, this would really tip the planet over the edge. And yet, if you look at the data, what we see is that it's the extraordinary inequality in the world that is already pushing our planet over what we could call planetary boundaries, tipping us into climate change. So, for example, if you ask how many people in the world don't have enough food to eat, there's about 11% of people in the world don't have enough food to eat. And what would it take to meet their needs? About 3% of the current global food supply. So if we could get 3% of the food that's already grown today, that would meet that would take everybody out of malnourishment. Is that doable? It's more than doable, because around 30 to 50% of all food that's currently produced is lost post-harvest. Mm. It's wasted in supermarket supply chains, or it gets scraped off our plates and into the bin in the kitchens. So we're looking for just 10% of what's not being eaten to end malnourishment. Now, of course, there are all sorts of questions about how you get food to people and the politics around people's hunger. But I'm talking at the mere provisioning scale of the planet. It's absolutely doable within the planetary means. There's a huge amount of inequality and waste in the process. If I can take another example on global carbon emissions, calculations have been done recent years that say around half of global carbon emissions are produced in the name of just 10% of the global population. And I think of that 10% of the global carbonistas, and let's be honest, we're amongst them. The population in the world who can take airplanes, who eat meat, who drive cars, this is where the global carbon emissions are coming from. So that's the place to start if we want to seriously reduce our carbon impact in the world. It's not saying people in Africa and Asia can't possibly have fridges and transport, because that's the wrong end of the problem to begin with.
How do we get to a place where economics, the practice of economics, respects social and planetary boundaries? Does that require a complete revolution, or is it something we can achieve through a gentle evolution?
Oh, I like that contrast. Is it revolution or evolution? I think it's a bit of both. I think the revolution has to come in the way we think. And that's why I've written the book I've written. The subtitle of my book is 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist, because I believe that the power of ideas, particularly the way we draw pictures, shapes the way we think. So I want to see a revolution in the economics that's taught in universities, so that when students go in for the first lecture, instead of being taught, say, supply and demand, which is a very typical first lecture that you learn in economics, you're taught to think about what the economy is in context and what it's for. What is the goal of the economy? I want to see a revolution in the ideas that students are taught today, because they really deserve to be taught economic thinking that's fit for the century that's coming. In fact, the student movement that's rebelling now in so many universities around the world is happening because the students know that the ideas they're being taught are not fit. So we need a revolution in the economic ideas that students are taught. But I think one of the exciting things is that when we start to think of the economy as an evolutionary system, because it is, it's a complex, evolving system, it's ever evolving, I think that's a very empowering idea. Because when systems evolve, that means that innovations or deviations that seem to be like fringe activities or something going on in the margins, they're actually the place where evolution really takes off. So when people set up, say, complementary currencies, they make a local currency like the Bristol Pound, that's a form of money that's specifically designed to help circulate within small-scale local businesses and make a local community thrive. When people protect their ideas not through traditional patenting and copywriting, but by putting them in the creative commons and using commons licensing. When people use not traditional money, but they might use a Bitcoin or blockchain currencies, all these things that sound quite weird and at the fringe activities, I think they're actually at the cutting edge of economic evolution. And you don't even have to be one of the leading entrepreneurs in one of these areas, because in fact, the way that all of us behave helps evolve the economy. So the way we travel, do we fly overseas, take the train, or actually go on holiday locally? The way we shop, which shops you buy from, or the way we eat, how much meat versus plant-based food do we eat? So the way we shop, eat, and travel helps to evolve the economy, because if a critical mass of us start changing the way we are consuming and spending, we start to change the patterns of the economy. But even how we vote, because we're not just consumers, we are citizens in facing elections and making choices in terms of the politicians whose politics and economics we choose. How we invest our money, how we divest our money, how we protest. All of these are ways in which we can individually be part of a critical mass that reshapes the economy. So I'm very excited by the evolutions that I see going on in economics, new business models where employee-owned companies instead of shareholder-owned companies, B Corps, where they put the social environmental value at the heart of the mission of what the company's for. All these small initiatives that seem at the fringes actually, I believe, are at the front edge of the evolution of the economy. So revolution in the way we think, evolution in what we do.
And do you think it will be a case of a combination of individual changes to lifestyle, to behaviour, and then some big progressive leaps forward from politicians, governments, and sort of led at the top? So there'll be a sort of a grassroots movement, and that will hopefully tip over politicians, convincing them to make big changes as well.
I think that I absolutely think both of those are important. I think in the way that, how does change happen in the world? We all want to know, how is this going to happen? And in my book, I've laid out all sorts of ideas of an economy that I can see emerging and that I believe will enable us to thrive this century. And of course, the first question is, how are we going to get there? Well, nobody knows how we're going to get there. We don't know where the future is going to come from. But what we know is you've got to give it a chance in many different places. So I believe that the groundswell of people innovating, living differently, as I said, shop, eating, and traveling differently, but also saying, if I'm an entrepreneur and I'm setting up a small-scale business, am I going to make it an employee-owned company, or am I going to try and make it shareholder-owned? If I've got a great innovation, am I going to patent it privately, or am I going to put it in the commons? We can all make these choices so we can have the groundswell of movement. But of course, it's not just about expecting individuals to change their behavior. That is never going to get us to where we need to go. We need leadership from companies, progressive companies that actually dare to buck the pressures of the stock market and follow progressive values that they say they live by, and they need to walk that talk. But also leadership from progressive politicians. And I'm honest, as many people share, I believe the view, we are seeing not nearly enough of that at the moment. I'm really worried that in Trump's America, Trump has gone back to being pro-growth and doesn't have a visionary idea of America's future at all. And I worry that in the UK, the focus on Brexit, we've seen leaked documents from the Department of International Trade saying we're going to do less work on climate change. Now the focus is trade and growth. So we're going back to what I would call 1960s economics, where we think growth will fix everything. We need progressive leadership from politicians, as well as from businesses, as well as from citizens. We need to give this thing a chance on all sides, because it's not going to happen automatically, and we need to make it happen as soon as possible.
Well, thinking about timing, I've heard you say before that what we do to the Earth during the next 50 years is going to shape the next 10,000. Is time on our side when it comes to making these important changes?
Yeah, these insights about the pressure we're putting on the Earth system, I mean, that particular phrase I've learned from Johan Rockström, who's one of the leading Earth system scientists behind the concept of planetary boundaries, which are the outer layer of my donut. And these Earth system scientists are saying we are pushing Earth into unprecedented, unknown place at the moment. The amount of carbon dioxide in the air hasn't been like this for 400 million years. We are putting Earth into a dangerous experiment that we're not even thinking why we're doing this, and it could be irreversible. Time isn't on our side. You know, I'm not going to say the nice, easy option, you know, it's plenty of time. Time isn't on our side. We are turning this into an emergency for ourselves, and we have to act now. So all the pressure, that all the demands for getting out of fossil fuels, the end to the tyranny of big oil, is really urgent, because we have left it almost as if just to give ourselves half a chance of doing this. It reminds me of kids playing chicken, that game where they play, where they run across the road at the last minute before the car. It's like we're playing an extraordinary game of chicken with the future of humanity on this planet. But I think we're being held back by extraordinary vested interests in big oil and big financial interests who benefit from the way that the economics and the economy is run at the moment. And it's up to us to peel the scales back from our eyes, see the power and the corruption that's going on there, and to overcome it. Uprising as citizens' movements, and demand that our politicians get big oil and these big vested interests out of their pockets and start serving the people's interests again.
For someone listening to our conversation today, what one thing would you suggest they can go out and do to make a positive difference and move towards this 21st century view of economics and approach that we need to take?
I think there's lots of different things that we can do. So I'm not going to say one thing, because we all have different, slightly different roles and influences in the world. If you're a teacher, how are you teaching students, whether they're 6 or 16, to think about our relationship to the living world? And how could you teach that differently? If you are working in a business, if you're employed in a company, what's the purpose of your company? Is it to maximize shareholder returns, or actually does it have a living purpose? And wouldn't you feel prouder of your company if it had a living purpose at its heart? How can you influence what your company is doing? How is it buying in supply chains around the world? If you're a parent, how do you talk to your children about the living world and why we don't fly on holiday fly in airplanes every holiday, and why we turn the lights off in our house? If you're an inventor, what kind of inventions are you making? Are they driven by a desire to help humanity thrive this century? So I think all of us can play different roles. If you're a pensioner, is there a place you could volunteer that you feel that you're contributing to either helping people get out of poverty and deprivation, or helping raise awareness or to improve the environment? So many of us in our own different roles in life can influence the communities that are around us, because we are all actually influential. It's easy for us to think, oh, I'm just a small person, you know, I'm just a consumer. But actually, we all have spheres of influence. And I think the best thing we can each do is reflect on that and think, actually, how can I use who I am in the world to in my way, to slightly start nudging this in a different direction? Because I think of the butterfly effect, you know, the flapping of a butterfly's wings on one side of the world could, through a complex system, stir up the winds of change somewhere else. Perhaps there's some way that we can all be butterflies here and actually start to bring about that change.
Kate, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Thank you for your time. Before you leave us, where can our listeners find out more about you? And most importantly, where can they buy a copy of your book?
Oh, well, it's great to talk with you. So my book came out last week, and I'm really delighted it's got off to a galloping start, which shows that there's a real hunger in the world for new economic thinking and a positive vision of the world we want to create. So the book is called Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. It's available in all good bookshops. Go out there and support your local bookshop. You can also buy it through online traders if that's the best access you have. And if you want to read more about it and see some of the wonderful animations that I've been making with some of the world's best stop motion animators, you can go to my website, which is www.katerayworth.com. And I'd love to be in touch with people there. You can also follow me on Twitter at Kate Rayworth, and I've got a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/donuteconomics.
Fantastic. We'll make sure we put links to all of those in the show notes too, so our listeners can find them nice and easily. Kate, thank you so much for your time today. That was brilliant.
My real pleasure. Cheers.
A big thank you to Kate for joining me on Informed Choice Radio today. I'm currently reading Donut Economics, and it genuinely is such an important book. Do check it out and find out more about the future of economics. Kate said during that interview, it's not just about expecting individuals to change their behaviour. We need leadership from companies, progressive companies that actually dare to buck the pressures of the stock market and follow progressive values that they say they live by, and that they need to walk that talk. What was your favourite part of that conversation? Let me know on Twitter at Martin Bamford or in the comment section in the show notes for this episode at icradio.co.uk. That's also where you can find useful links and the full transcript for this episode. Please say thank you also to Kate on Twitter, where you can find her at Kate Rayworth. I would love your review of Informed Choice Radio on Apple Podcasts. Visit icradio.co.uk/iTunes, where you can leave us your rating and review. Ratings push us higher up the Apple Podcasts charts, and it helps us to reach more new listeners. It just takes a moment to leave a rating and review, and we will, of course, read it out in a future episode. Thank you for listening to this episode, and thank you for your continued support of this podcast. Until next time, I'm Martin Bamford. This is Informed Choice Radio. And remember, when it comes to your money, the more you know, the faster it can grow.